G'day and welcome to the Mountain Cat Guitars podcast, where we discuss all things guitar related. My name is Doug Meyer, owner of Mountain Cat Guitars, and I've been buying and selling guitars professionally for over 25 years. From boutique guitar and amp builders, vintage guitar dealers and experts, guitar repairmen and luthiers, retailers, manufacturers, and of course guitar players, we talk to the people who buy, sell, play, and of course obsess over the things we love most, guitars.
Yeah, no.
Hi, this is Doug Meyer from Mountain Cat Guitars, and welcome to the Mountain Cat Guitars podcast. We are in the Guitar Shop NYC in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, which is a super awesome place where we are partnering up with our friends out here at Leaving the Boutique Guitars and stuff out here. They have tons of bass gear. They have repair guys. Moschino is here. Cobra. James Carbonetti is here. And Eric from Labella Strings is here. It's a super groovy place. And today, we have Matt Rubendahl as our guest. This is him. And he builds classic guitars out here in Brooklyn and makes Ruby Knights, which are these amazing handmade knives, which we'll discuss as we go along. How are you, Matt?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I am doing good. So let's start right at the top. Where are you from? I know you're not from around New York.
No, born in Indiana.
Indiana, right.
Yep.
I knew that.
In the Midwest. Left in the 80s after high school. Just moved.
And somehow you ended up in Ithaca, right?
I did. I was living in Hawaii.
Oh, right.
On the beach. And
so you went to Ithaca? Where it snows every day?
Yes, and I have a friend who was traveling with me who was a little shifty, and someone owed him money in Ithaca for a drug debt, so
I never heard this.
No. So
it's going better than I thought already.
We camped out in the Honolulu airport for a week, and while someone wired us money and then we flew, that's all I got to Ithaca for.
I love that story.
Yeah.
And then you settled there?
Yeah, I did.
Did you get the money in Ithaca?
No. It's not a trustworthy business.
Yeah.
No, I just ended up. I ended up staying there because I'd been traveling for a little bit.
I think it's cool. I've spent a lot of time there.
No, it is. It's beautiful. There's a lot of the quality of musicians in Ithaca is super high.
Yeah, it always was.
Yeah, there's a great music school, and also that's how I started doing guitars because I learned there's a bunch of people who make things.
Did you work at Ithaca Guitar Works?
I did.
You did, right?
Yep. Upstairs.
That was before Rumbleseat was there.
Rumbleseat was there, yeah, but
it was a smaller version.
Yeah, there was. He moved a few times.
What year were you there? When you were in Ithaca?
I think I was there probably in 92.
Oh, way after I was. Because I went to college in Syracuse.
Ah.
And I used to hang out in Ithaca all the time. I had a girlfriend in Ithaca, and I played in a band in Ithaca.
Wow, what band?
It never really did anything. It was a bunch of my friends from high school.
No, it's okay. What band? What was the name?
You guys
play it like at the 90s or something?
No, it was, you know, it was always just kind of jamming, really.
Okay.
You know, like one of my friends went to Cornell, one friend went to Ithaca, and I had a girlfriend there, so I was always down there anyway, but it never quite turned into much.
I had no idea.
And that was like the mid-80s, you know, it was a long time ago. College and all that, but I used to hang out at the golf time.
I'm going to ask questions now. Did you go to the 9s at all?
I did a lot.
Did you see Pete Panic? The blues guy? He worked there.
Guy.
Oh, he was really good.
We used to go see, like, dead bands. It was, like, Group Effort. There was a bunch of dead bands back then. You know those guys?
There's a lot of bands back then. Blind Man's Holiday.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, the worst.
Yeah. But I used to like it. It was cool.
Yeah, so I lived there. Then I worked for Ithaca Guitar Works.
And then, so when I met you, you were with Chris Traynor.
Yes, so I don't even know how I went to New York because a friend, it was Ray Hall. Do you know Ray?
With the recording studio?
Sound guy.
Right.
I had known him.
I met him through you guys. That was the theater place downtown.
Yeah, I met him because he was a friend of a friend of mine from Ithaca.
Right, who's an engineer.
He was an engineer, but I had a friend who knew him, and so that's how I got introduced. Anyway, he called me and said that they're starting some guitar store thing, so do I want to come do that?
And that's why you moved here?
Yeah, be taken advantage of, and I said, sure. Great.
And then was Chris already involved in that?
No, he was not.
Oh, so you were involved in that first?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, so I was involved with that. And then the reason why I met Chris through Chelsea. That's how he got involved.
Oh, right, and that's Chris Traynor, our buddy, who we worked with forever, and he's in Bush.
and he worked at Chelsea, and he's been in a billion bands and all that stuff. But they got, when I remember meeting you, because I remember going to Rivington.
Yes.
It was, you guys were already there.
Yeah.
And he introduced me to you, and you guys, you were already doing the Rivington thing.
Yeah.
You know, and you guys knew the guy who owned the building or something, right?
Well, no, the guy who was running it, who started it, I don't know. He also rented the studio.
Right. Because Craig used to rehearse in studio, and then Howie had it at that point.
Right, yeah.
You know, that was after you. Well, you, from there, came to work with us at Chelsea.
For a little bit, yes. I did that, and then...
Not for very long.
I had a studio in the Lower East Side where I was making things and also doing repair also.
Right.
And then moved to Brooklyn.
Right, because I remember... Right, because you guys were working at Rivington. I think Chris went and did something. And then you were leaving there. Because at one point, I think they offered me that job.
At
Rivington.
Yeah, no, I had to get
And it. I said no, because I was happy at Chelsea.
Yeah.
And then you came and worked with us at Chelsea for a while.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. That's where I put a screwdriver through my thumb working there at Chelsea.
Was I there for that?
No, 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 really long one. I put it right through my thumb one day.
Yeah, I don't think that was
well, shortly after that, I didn't go back.
Without, you know, you were before, you were there right after Klosted or during Klosted.
Yeah, no, I think we were all working there together.
Before Craig, though.
We did shifts.
Did you ever work at the same time as
yeah.
Matt?
Yeah. Yes. For like months.
From, yeah. It's hard to figure out who was
like
there
6 when. Months before he just said, I'm never coming back here again. Good luck. It's all on you now.
Yeah, Matt was really abrupt. You're like, I don't work here anymore. Bye.
Handed in the hammer.
Yeah. Get your fucking hammer. I'm out of here. Yeah, you would like, there was something with storage and Danny or something that upset you.
I helped Danny organize his storage.
Yeah, that usually most people have it right there, yeah.
Well, yeah. He had $1 million guitar cases, $1 million amps. And, I helped, yeah, then after that I had
to. I remember that. I was like, yeah, Matt's not coming back.
That's the concept of storage in New York is people pay so much. By the time you're done paying for your storage, you actually paid more than everything and anything is worth.
Times 1,000.
But, yeah. And then you have to work.
And then it gets flooded.
Yeah.
Everyone knows has a storage space in New York City. It gets flooded.
Yeah. It was on the seventh floor and it got flooded. Yeah.
Exactly. So we worked at Chelsea Guitars. And then, well, now you build classical guitars.
Yeah.
Somehow you got, you weren't building classical guitars then. You were sort of doing it, but you didn't have
guitars. No, I was doing it in Ithaca.
Right.
And then I came to New York. And
you were
I had little shops.
Real.
Yeah, I was repairing. I had little shop spaces, but it was really difficult to try and do that.
Right.
You know, they were rinky dinky things in basements here and there.
Right.
It's very difficult to do that. So then after that, when I moved to Brooklyn, that's when I started doing it in earnest.
Right.
And that's
but you didn't really do repairs much. You did this.
Yeah.
Were you still doing repairs?
I was still doing repairs. I mean, you know, I'll do anything.
Right.
Guitar related for money.
Yeah, because when I first opened Mountain Cat, I didn't know anybody yet up by me who could do the work that you could do, like Harry doing exits. So we were running out to you, and where you were on the water. You're not still in that same space, are you?
No, I moved from Red Hook to Gowanus to Sunset Park.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, so you're here?
Yeah, I'm just down the street.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
58th Street, yeah.
Your shop is in right here?
Yeah, just down there.
Oh, interesting. You must have told me this last time.
No, it's funny. I moved. It just keeps getting farther and farther out. It's the story.
But you moved out here. You live out here.
I live in Flatbush.
Right, because you were one of the first people I knew who moved out
there. Oh, right, to somewhere besides Williamsburg.
Back then, you were like a pioneer.
Yeah, well, I mean, that and the people who lived there since the 1630s. Other than that,
they might have been pioneers, but you were like...
And then the Indians had been there for 10,000 years.
Right,
other than
you were
that,
a pioneer.
I was the first.
But I remember you going out there. You bought a big building, right? You bought a building or an apartment?
Apartment, yeah.
So I remember that, and you rehabbed it and all that because you're handy.
Sort of, yeah.
I'm making it sound better than it is.
No, it's a palace.
No, I remember that. Because that was a big deal, because I didn't know anybody who moved to that area back then.
Oh, no, I didn't know anyone. Flatbush back then was a little, you know, it was a little dicey.
Now it's nicer, isn't it?
It's nice, nicer. I mean, the quality of, you know, the Caribbean neighborhood is still partly intact, so it's pretty cool that way. It's just, you know, a bunch of fancy white people in my building. I hate those people. I know, they're so annoying. Well, first, every day we used to get asked if we were lost.
I love
someone
that.
Someone would walk up and say, "You guys, where are you trying to get to?" And like, we live here.
No, we're
yeah, and then the building's very old, very Caribbean, super nice, very kind of formal almost. And then it's just totally changed. Everyone died, and then it got filled up with other people.
Regular people.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, it did.
That was a Caribbean area?
Yep, Flatbush. Well, Flatbush was this, well, other than the Dutch name when it was started, but it was an immigrant neighborhood, you know, probably Italian, Irish, Jewish in the turn of the century.
Right, well, I know people's grandmothers
30s.
Lived in Flatbush.
And
you know.
Every war movie, the kid is from Flatbush.
Right, exactly.
Jewish kid.
Exactly.
And then in,
the Lords of Flatbush, remember that movie?
Then Caribbean, it became a Caribbean neighborhood, huge Caribbean neighborhood.
Yeah, it's so interesting how that happens. Like, an area is something, and then it's Dominican.
Yeah.
Like, you go up to the Bronx, and those yeah. like, all these areas that were Jewish, Italian, Irish.
And I'm guessing it's because of the train and the subway pushing farther out, maybe
right.
about 1910 or 15.
Right. So,
but, just, you know, people move suburbs, other things,
right.
other people move
yeah, people
in.
Move out, other people move in. That's kind of what the Bronx is now.
Yeah.
Like, the Bronx is all different. My family's from the Bronx. You know, everyone who...
Do they still own a house in the Bronx?
No.
That's too bad.
No, they moved out when I moved out. Oh. Well... I was two.
Right.
So I kind of just went where they went.
You didn't have a down payment.
I didn't have a lot of... They didn't really ask me where I wanted to live.
Yeah.
You know, like... So we were,
sucks.
We wound up moving pretty much where I live now, which is weird. You know, because I moved pretty much 10 miles from where my father
right.
lived.
But you moved back to the city at some point.
I lived in the city for 20 years.
Right.
You know...
It was like right above the... that bar, Western...
The rodeo bar.
The rodeo
right
bar.
Around the corner.
Yes.
Right, it was my favorite bar in New York.
Yes.
And I always lived within a six... I moved to 22nd and 3rd when I moved to the city. Then I moved to 24th and 3rd. Then I bought a place on 28th and 3rd.
Right, I remember.
So that was my six-block journey. And then moved to where I live now.
Which is where?
Suffern, New York. Mm. Which is right on the New York-New Jersey border. So, but it's only like 26 miles from New York City.
Right.
Like, you know... So it's close. It took us like an hour to get here. You know, like, so it's a cool spot. I love Suffern. You should really come up with
it. To Suffern?
Suffern.
Oh, Suffern.
Yeah, everybody loves that. So let's get right into this. Well, so you started building these guitars, obviously.
I've been building classical guitars, yeah, for 20 some years. And the reason why is I was a classical guitar player, pretty serious about it. And I had a crappy guitar. And so, you know, being the genius that I was, I said, I'll just make one. I mean, how hard can that be? And then I still don't own one of my own, but...
That always happens.
Yeah, I quit playing guitar after I started making
them. Yeah, I don't see you play much guitar.
Yeah, just something about it, just... Maybe it was the guitar players, too many of them, just really ruined it for me or something.
But were you a classical guitar student?
Yep, I actually wanted to try out for university.
Oh, I know I did.
Yeah.
And you played just classical, or were you rock?
Oh, no, I played the bluegrass, jazz, a lot of stuff like that. But I was self-taught, so, you know, it's good I didn't go to school, because I wasn't, you know. If you're not kicking ass at 11 on classical guitar,
yeah, you're
probably,
fucked,
yeah. You got to be great when you're younger.
I went to a classical guitar school. Like, so I went to Syracuse University, but attached to it was Krauss College of Music, which was a classical music school. So I took... classical guitar, of course, which you know, I had no intention of pursuing in any way. I just thought it'd be
those kids get serious. It's pretty cutthroat.
Oh yeah,
I'm like, Jesus Christ. And it's like the same
it's like ballet
songs
dancers
over and over
or something.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not doing it by 4 years old, you're fucked.
Yeah,
you know, like,
and most of them, I think, and it must be tough because most of the teachers know there's a lot of good students, and you can you know, you don't have to be the world's best to play guitar. That's not, you know, the goal of it, but
right.
you know, for performing on classical guitar, you know, you have to be good, or you have to be teach it. Which
right.
is fine too. Which
right.
would probably make a shitload more money teaching than you would ever.
Right. Unless you want to be a performer. Right. You know.
Yeah. And even performers for stuff, I don't think they make.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's like, you know, you're.
No one's throwing panties at classical guitar players on stage.
You sure?
Sure. Pretty sure.
You would know better than I would. But
yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not happening.
That sucks. Never? You can figure that out. But. So who primarily plays your guitars? Like, you're, you know, these professional guitars, I assume.
Yeah, no, the clientele that I have in New York is classical guitar players, and those are anything from students to grad students to professors in that world, performers, people who, you know, just love classical guitar, maybe took it in college or just want to, you know, that's what they like. Jazz players, because New York has a pretty good nylon string jazz scene.
Right.
And Brazilian, I see a lot of Brazilian.
Oh, right,
players.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and so Brazilians, you know, either for choro music or just straight up jazz, or, you know, any of the music. Brazilian music is all on nylon strings,
right.
So, and those guys are sort of naturally gifted by genetics for
right.
guitar playing. It's insane, actually.
Yeah, Brazilians are naturally good for a lot of stuff.
Music, man. It's just they're music, I never had a lot of
they can do all kinds of shit.
Guys who and women, men who play, and they're just good, better than me.
But so I assume you have a line of these. I assume the student level ones and
nope. I make whatever I make. So I don't have. I mean, I do make it. I make Romantic era instruments, which are much smaller, like French, like 1780, 1820s, sort of like rough copies of like a Lakote or something along those lines. And I made a few of those.
We'll put up pictures of those because I'm sure you don't have one.
And I do. Here. You know, the jazz stuff is very similar, except with cutaway for the classical. But I make them exactly the same way. And I will put, I have put handmade little pick guards and stuff with the cutaway stuff, so it's a little bit more accessible for that. But yeah, I just basically make one kind of, there is no lesser model.
And do you make them to order, or you just make guitars?
I make them for commissions. I'm working on commissions now. I would like to tell you that I have 20 years of them, but that's a total utter lie. I tell people it's a 2-year waiting list, so it looks better, but
well, they may see them.
By the time this comes out, I'll have 2 years.
Now you'll have a 2-year.
And then so, I'll make one that's not in commission to take to a dealer. So, this one is a shop guitar. So I have one or two of these that sort of I bring out to show or if people want to play one. If I don't have a new one or something, so they can get an idea of exactly what they are. And then I take them to the dealer in New York, and the only place really that does that around here, well, there's two, but mainly Savage Guitar. They're in Long Island?
No.
So he's in the last 2 years, he's become one of the biggest dealers of classical guitars on the East Coast.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yep.
He's
a retired broker.
There were always those places, we would get classical, we'd get Ramirez's at Chelsea, and we'd call that place in the city.
Yeah, there's a
very nice
Guitar Salon.
Right.
Yeah. And so she does, Beverly is, she's been doing it. She's in her 80s. She's been doing it a long time. And she primarily does historical stuff.
Oh, is that right?
So, if she's looking for, the 60-year-old Hausers, the Spanish stuff.
Right.
The things that she,
Yes, we would get those things at Chelsea occasionally. We'd call her because you would know.
Classical guitars is one of those things where you can take a crappy one and look at it, and you can take another one, and they look almost identical, and one's worth $50,000, and one's
worth $10. It's like horns in the same way.
Yeah.
We would get horns, and you'd be like, it's a Selmer, but is it a Selmer?
And a lot of times you play them, and they're like, these sound exactly the same.
Right.
Yeah,
we got a big deal Ramirez at Chelsea one time,
a really old one?
Yeah, it was worth quite a bit of money.
Because the early ones are the late 19th century. They're 18.
Yeah, I remember it was a big 70s. Deal.
Yeah.
When we called her, it was the real thing.
Yeah.
Derek sold it. We sold it, but it didn't sound that amazing to me. That I'm not tuned into classical guitars, but
they have a lifespan. Everything. Right. There's a maturity curve.
Some sound amazing and some don't.
Yeah, and so it just depends. So. They do take on. I've played some very expensive old guitars, and they have a very cool sound.
Right.
Super lush, quiet, not quite the same.
Right.
But
kind of like an old Martin or an old Gibson. A lot goes on with those. Some are amazing.
Yeah.
Some are like meh.
It's not like the violin family where you're going to be playing a 15-20 Italian instrument somewhere. Right. The guitars will not last that long.
Is that right?
I don't think they would. No, they're just, I think the setup, the flatness of the tops.
And the big giant hole and all kinds of false.
Yeah, I mean, and the
can't
violin
you keep
is,
rebuilding it or not really?
You can keep rebuilding them, but then they sort of, I like entropy. I think, things have a natural lifespan and then they just fall apart and they suck.
Well, so. When was the first, say, guitar made? What do we consider the first?
I'm not a real good, but, Villanuevas. And then some, I think it was probably, again, I should know this, but I don't. But, probably the late 1700s, early
1800s. So this guitar is from the early 1800s then?
Yeah, the 1820s, 1830s. I mean, Torres is considered the father of modern guitar making because he made a guitar that was relatively the same size as what we're using today. And six courses, whereas a lot of the earlier things like Villanuevas, they're double courses. Even though they had six strings, they were double courses.
Right.
Just tune up like that. But, yeah, I think you can probably say early 19th century is when it really came into its.
And are those still around? Can you?
Yep, I played a few of them. They're still around.
Are they sound good?
No, those are the ones that I played that sounded. Yeah, they sound really beautiful, lush, but not very loud. You can't perform on them. Just like an early any Stradivarius in its original form you couldn't play today because the neck sets were too low because of string tension. So all every Stradivarius has had the neck reset and all this work done to it.
Oh,
so just to raise that. So
see, I don't know anything about that. You know, we did electric guitars and like acoustic guitars, but not that kind of stuff. Like, you know, these things are special to like horns. You know, everyone's like, oh, I got a saxophone. Like, I remember like Danny started getting into buying those old Selmers.
Yeah.
You know, but that's a whole specialty. Like, you have to spend your whole life doing that.
Yes.
You know?
It's funny, there's still, I had some Japanese buyers who came to me every year up until the site certified treaty ruined my business with them. But they were looking for classical guitars. They had a store in Tokyo, a big one, and old horns. Yep.
Well, that's why Danny did it. He always kind of had a read on that, like, and then he started buying all these old horns.
Yep, and then they would come and they would ask me, and it was, and they would pay me with cash, and they would hand it to me like this, and it was awesome, and I'm like, thank you.
This is weird. Still going to be
interesting. That's fine. Well, what happened was I was sending guitars to them, and they're lovely people, except the after 2017, the CITES treaties with Rosewoods went into, so every all Rosewoods were now level 2. Versus level 3 or whatever,
right.
Whatever. So I had to get a permit to send this out of the country, and it took 7 months to do that to the government.
Oh shit!
Yeah, it was miserable. So
I got one of those permits because I was importing Brazilian rosewood guitars.
Right.
It didn't take that long though. Like
to import them, you were importing them.
Yeah. Oh, it's worse to export.
Well, I mean, for me, because I got a single use one, because I don't do it a lot. I mean,
right.
I'm not doing, you know, a guitar a month like that. So. Yeah, no, it was terrible. It was right. I don't know if it was just people were pissed, but it took so long.
It's like so many people trying to get it at the same time. Cause
well, it's just all it was a form, and the woman or man had to do is just look at it and be like, okay, and send it back to me. But
right.
It took 7 months of sitting in an office. And then there was a lot of things that got screwed up. And then once I got the thing back, it still has to be stamped. And then you have to go to an USDA forest place to get it. And
right.
Like, you've got to be kidding me. So I had to make an appointment to go to the airport.
Oh shit!
To have some like forest ranger look at it, stamp it, and we'll say.
Oh man,
yeah,
mine wasn't quite as bad, but I had like because I was importing these guitars from Israel that they offered Brazilian rosewood as an option.
Right.
Completely legit.
Are these blues electric guitars?
Yeah.
I think I know the person.
They're a B&G guitar.
I think I know.
In Tel Aviv.
Yeah, I met a person.
Big company now.
Who made these? They're a friend of someone. I can't remember.
They
look like kind of like bluesy design concept.
Yeah, they kind of look like you know, like Robert Johnson's guitars, what they're based on. Really nice.
Yeah.
But they, I think they still offer Brazilian rosewood.
I wonder if they can
like,
get it.
They do it really legitimately, but they all get hung up in customs.
Huh.
At Bayonne, New
Jersey. I should just lie is what I should do. But
internet.
Oh right, internet. But then if you get caught,
they kill you.
Yeah, no, they you. Disappeared in the middle of the night by a bunch of dudes in a pickup force.
Yeah,
guys.
Black masks.
Yeah, bury you there. But I mean, or you can just say the guitar is a certain wood that it's not.
Right.
Know? So and a lot of times, so now all these woods.
Well, that's so Brazilian rosewood is, you know, whatever it is, and there's Indian rosewood and this other rosewood. Is there any way, like, say you ship the guitar, is there any way to tell the origin of the rosewood?
Well, I mean, you can tell by looking at it up close.
You could.
I
can tell Brazilian rosewood from India.
Yeah, I can tell Brazilian. Some Brazilian and Indian sort of mix color wise and stuff, and it can be a little difficult.
Right, I've seen them look different colors.
And, I mean,
but
it's
you can tell by grain patterns or
you could, color and grain. It's easier if you can take it apart. You know, burn a little piece of it, see how it smells. You know,
right.
How they smell.
But some guy at a border can would never be able to tell.
And that's the problem.
He's trained.
And then the problem is it so then you have to rely on idiots working. You know,
right. Having itself, it's Brazilian rosewood.
But then the problem is the same thing happens is where someone, a violinist, I heard the story, she was coming into the States to play a concert.
They take the violin, right?
And they wanted to take her bows and destroy them on the spot because they had a little bit of tortoise shell, but they were made 1720. And she was like, no, these were made 1720.
Right.
And she had to leave the country. She had to get on a flight and go home or they would have destroyed them.
Oh,
because they're
God.
Too stupid. You know, so the rule is not everyone understands how that works. So
we hear about that thing where people get their guitar seized.
Right. Well, if it's before 1992, you're fine. Because in 1992, Brazilian rosewood became, you have to show proof of where you got it. So if you have rosewood stocks, and this is the shitty part, I think if you have rosewood stocks now, and you build a brand new guitar, you might not have the receipt from 92 when you bought it, and you're screwed. So you can't ship it out of the country. You can only use it to a person who lives here. And then what are they going to do? They can't take it anywhere else. And it's sort of, you know, I just had someone offer me wood to sell or wood to buy. I mean, you might know him. you don't have to put his name, but CJ Thompson. No, CJ, maybe he lived in Florida. Repair guy was also in Tennessee. CJ, anyway, but he didn't have a receipt for it. And I'm like, you know, and he wanted, I think he wanted a lot of money. I'm like, there's absolutely no way.
Right, you can't do anything with it.
What am I going to do? Yeah, I can't.
Is it Brazilian rose?
Yeah, but I mean, I can't resell it. If, you know, they'd never come to my shop to check, but if they ever did, I have no way to prove that I bought it.
Right.
Except, you know.
But what if you bought a bunch of Brazilian rosewood in 1984 from some guy down the block from you?
I think it's a, I think it's difficult. Then you have no way to prove it if you don't have the receipt.
Right.
So, I don't know. There must be some kind of mechanism.
They're very serious about it.
They're very serious. Yeah. If you ship, the guy was telling me if you ship a piece of the Met ship's furniture, they have to get a permit because there's a lot of, like, old endangered. Say it's a,
right. But it's a big problem. I don't.
And then they have to get a permit to get it back.
I don't sell that much to Europe anymore, I think, because of all this stuff.
Nobody does.
They don't want to deal with it.
No one wants to buy them here, you know, because they. The,
they know you're going to
be a
problem.
There's going to be a huge problem.
I deal with builders who ship me stuff. I don't have a big problem with that, because right. They fill out the paperwork.
Right. They fill out the paperwork.
They have to deal with the CITES thing. Yeah. I don't deal with it. But it's a big pain in the ass, because I deal with, you know, fell in England, a bunch of Canadian people. Yeah. I still have, I don't sell B&G guitars anymore, but I have another company, Tone Revival, that's in Tel Aviv. But that's not Brazilian rosewood, so. Right.
So I start to use, like, the next guitars I'm making them out of maples, I make them out of Zeracote, I make them out of something that is not, you know. So that basically, stuff, right? I don't know, does this mean that it'll just drive unendangered woods to be endangered? Probably.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, were you building these guitars out of Brazilian rosewood?
No, I never used it.
So it doesn't matter anymore.
No, well...
Well, the boards.
Well, the Indian rosewood is also certified.
So is that? Oh, that's right. All rosewood.
All rosewoods. Every single one.
Oh, there lies the big problem.
So that's why Gibson is probably, you know, going out of business in some sense, because then, A, they got in trouble for importing Madagascar and ebony or something.
Right, but that was sounding like bullshit anyway. Right?
Yeah, but it was probably the CITES certification thing they're trying to go around. And then they have to get, you know, I'm sure that the hassle to sell it to overseas now has gotten even worse. So
let's look at this one while it's here.
Sure.
Because this looks like rosewood, no?
Yep, it is. I can explain. So I make a fairly traditional shaped instrument. You know, a lot of, you know, classical guitar builders or buyers want, you know, they want you to drink the Kool-Aid. Everyone seems to want, like, some traditional, a lot of people, like, this was made just like they made them in 1810.
Right, you know? I can see that. It's like vintage guitars.
Except
want stuff like they made in the 50s.
Except in 1810, stupid, right? If those guys had epoxy and super glue, they would have used it everywhere, you know?
Right. What did they have? Horse stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's just they want you to use the same materials, but I guarantee if they had, like, spray finishes in 1810 in Spain, it was
for everyone. Both?
Yeah.
Wow, this thing sounds incredible.
But yeah, so I make, you know, this is a few years older, but, you know, elevated necks. I use, the construction is a little bit different. I use double sides. This has a double back, actually. The top is very traditional. It's just very simple fan bracing.
Double back means what? There's another back under this?
Yeah, so I use two sets. So double sides is a thing they use in a classical guitar.
Well, you can see it in this one. This has a sound ball, I assume. Right?
Yeah, all you're trying to do is just make sure that the top moves and the sides don't. So
it just,
yeah, so you just want projection, and nylon strings don't have a lot of chutzpah, so in order to do that, you have to make everything solid on the top.
This is really doing that, though.
It will project a lot, and it's cool, these whole...
You can feel it.
Yeah, it's actually a great... I don't know why more people don't do it. I love it. I think
you see it now, like, we went to the Woodstock Guitar Show, and you see a lot of those things on the sides now,
You can open them, you can close them, whatever kind of thing. It just lets you hear it, so you don't, you know... Especially something like a classical...
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, because you play guitar, but it goes there.
It's projecting, but that lets you hear it.
You can actually hear it.
Yeah. I say it's sort of like having two radios on to the same station in your house, and there's a little delay, kind of stereo delay, you can hear it. And also, just when people play the guitar, they can hear how it sounds, so... They're more likely to buy it.
Just think this one's loud.
Yeah. Cedar.
No, is it cedar for flamenco guitars? Or that's not the same.
Well, cedar and spruce, same. Cedar is just moody, you know, just a little darker sounding.
And this is cedar.
And cedar, and so and spruces are have a little bit higher end, so they're a little bit more sparkling on the top.
This one's pretty sparkly.
Yeah, no, this one does sound.
But I'm never really.
I'm also using probably. I'm using the bracing is probably like German spruce, so I'm not using the same kind of bracing as the top is.
I don't really. Play these kind of guitars that often, but this thing is incredible.
Yeah, they're meant to protect, you know, and in the hands of someone,
really
not saying that you stop the guitar, but in the hands of, like, a classical, right. neoclassical player, they're really...
Yeah.
They could take something and make it sound like a fucking hand.
Right. Yeah. You know, they can really do that thing, right?
Some people who play stuff, you know, come in and it's just like, you're like, I'm never playing guitar.
Yeah, sure.
I never played guitar.
Isn't the thing like the low E string with classical guitars?
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you want out of it. You know, the cedar's a little growly, you know what I mean? It's got a growl to it. And a lot of Spanish guitars also have a little bit of that growl. But, you know, it's tough because the guitar itself, nylon strings have very low tension. So you have to make them loud with low tension, and so it, you know, it's a balancing act.
This thing is loud.
Yeah, it can be, you know, done right.
I've never played classical games loud like this.
And then, you know, nuts and saddles are compensated.
Oh, yeah, a little bit.
So I cut a little bit of the fretboard off so the nut sits further up, about a millimeter, and then the E slot is back. The G is front forward. This E slot's 3/4 millimeter back.
Oh, wow.
So everything, so that's, and then all those are all different. So it just puts the string.
It looks like those early, what were those things called that the guy in Grand Funk played? Microfrets.
Oh, like mini?
Yeah, like everything was compensated like this.
Right. Oh, no, they do. They have those. Make those microtonal fret jobs.
Right.
Yes. I just say take the frets out and then you can play whatever microphone.
But this is all right. But this is all compensated properly, so it
always because plays, you know, the problem with classicals, and I've always, you buy a $30,000, you know, old Spanish guitar, and the compensation sucks.
The compensation's out, right?
So it doesn't matter. You know, one of the things about guitar making that at least I want to do is the thing has got to, it's got to look good. I mean, I think a lot of people put too much focus on how the thing looks these days, right. Which because there's so many people doing it. But the thing has got to, it's got to work. It's got to, like, perform, it's got to last a long time, and it has to do the job it's supposed to
right.
do, or it's not worth
it. And the raised fretboard thing is, I assume...
Well, it's for two reasons, because, A, it's a little bit easier, the joint between the cedar, spruce, and mahogany is less detrimental than straight ebony, which right. is the two most disparate woods as far as, like, contraction and expansion. Two, classical guitars have a negative neck angle, which is a lot of repair people F up if they don't use to them, because the neck angle is going down rather than up, where everything else is pointing up. So an old Martin, if you look along the edge, the top of the fretboard should hit the top of the bridge.
Right.
Right? So, and that way the compensation for height
right, this is not
settle. And so this is negative neck angle, because the parabola string of these, when these go, they, you know, they do a parabola, sort of like a round thing, and they travel quite a lot, so you need a lot
right,
of
yeah.
room down here so that they don't
hit the board.
Well, so they don't hit the board. So if this right. is a flat neck angle, like flamencos are flat neck angles, hence why they buzz so much, because they want them to buzz, and also because they're like long hairs who want to play really fast and impress people. And but that's why the neck angle on those is flat. And that's why if you play, they're kind of buzzy, you know,
right.
because of that.
But this is super clean when you play.
Yeah, and it just also, I mean, you could make these things fart out at any one given time, but it just gives you a little bit more advantage. And so new guitars that I build, this whole mechanism pops out. It's not glued in at all. It's just held in by tension, by a little cantilever here. And there's a set screw here and a set screw here, and these are also flat, so that you can just up the set screw, and it'll actually tilt the neck instead of that, and the action can change because the neck angle changes. So you can lower the neck angle, so you can have the bridge is permanent, it never moves. You just lower it and raise the neck.
Itself. That's interesting. Does that change the sound at all?
You know, no, it does not. I actually think it's a little bit better.
Right, it's one of those things where people be like, oh, you can't do that.
I've had guitar makers tell me don't do that because if you don't have a connection.
The contact, right.
And I'm like, how do you know? I mean, right. how do you know? I mean, you got to do it. But I think right. actually it's better.
Right, that's the thing. Like, everyone thinks like, oh, a two-piece telly body can't sound good. You got to get a one-piece telly body.
Right.
But the real tellies weren't two one-piece telly bodies.
No.
They were two-piece, three-piece, four-piece. They were all kinds
yeah, a lot of people will use different kinds of spruce for the tops. That's not book matched also right. So depending on it's just got to be the right
yeah, a lot of those misconceptions I'm sure you get tons of them Because you get an electric guitars, and electric guitars aren't nearly as complicated as something like this.
No, and also people, when they see something, and if it's not quite normal, they want to know why it's
right.
something, because they see a guitar that's worth a lot of money, like, I want that same thing.
Right.
But that's not necessarily
the same thing. People call up, and they would want, I would carry, like, a Tele Builder, and they'd be like, oh, I want a one-piece body like the 50s guitars. And they'd be like, but the 50s guitars weren't one-piece bodies. Yeah. You know, we offered one-piece body, but the 50s guitars weren't like that.
Right.
And they're like, oh. Then they're confused. And then you ask someone like Johan, who makes tellies all day, I asked him, I said, is there any possible way you could hear the difference between a two-piece body and one-piece body? He's like, no.
I mean, I think people also, they sort of think that those, like the Gibson factory in the 50s, it was a bunch of drunk rednecks who were making shit in wherever, and there was no, like, science.
This will matter 50 years
from now. There's no science. They're like, I want to get paid.
It's Friday. I want to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
You know, like, there are a lot of misconceptions. Yeah, that's where it was like 50s guitars, it's got to be this, it's got to be that. But those were just cats going to a job.
Yeah.
You know, some of them were talented.
Yeah, no,
they made really good guitars.
They were good at what they did, and they sounded
really
good.
The materials were available. Those cats were, a lot of them European, were brought over because they had those skills still. They were around still in the 50s. Some of them made them into the 60s. But they made beautiful handmade guitars because that's what was made in the 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the 60s, everything changed. They needed more guitars, bigger factories. They had to start moving faster, and then the guitars changed.
Yeah.
You know, and those guys probably retire. They're probably old guys in the 50s. As in the 60s, they probably started dropping off, and the guitars started sucking. You know, or they just need to make more.
Yeah.
So they couldn't use nitro lacquer.
And so it's why you will get a J45, a 40s J45, and some of them are amazing. One of my favorite guitars.
Yeah.
And some of them are just terrible because they were just putting tops on. They weren't voicing. They weren't doing anything.
Right. You know? Yeah. They don't do you do.
And a lot of guys in the classical world, the amount of different, I think the classical builders are the ones that experiment more than anybody else. I mean,
yeah, especially when you would go to, like, I don't go to the shows, but I go to the Woodstock guitar show because it's cool. And you see mostly classical builders and jazz guy builders, and there's some amazing things. Like, whoa!
Because the tops
people are really pushing the envelope.
Double tops, they use tops with Nomex, they use tops with balsa wood, they carve tops from the inside.
Right, yeah, there's all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like where you don't see that. I don't deal with much handmade boutique acoustic steel string guitars.
Yeah.
Like a mighty niche turned into like electric guitars. That are basically, I do vintage guitars, and most of the boutique guitars I do are somehow based on vintage guitars,
right.
Even if they don't really look like it, they're somehow they are. You know, so there's no one's really pushing the envelope that much, really. But then you do see all these boutique electric guitars where people are going way out there.
I love it. I follow some of those guys on that Instagrams things, and they're
doing amazing things.
There's some really, and the reason why Gibson is going out of business, because a brand new Les Paul is, what, $3,500,
$4,500? The shitty one, right.
And one of these guitars is $2,800, $3,500, same thing.
So they're made by hand.
But they're made by hand. They're really cool looking, and they have all these, like, a lot of people are copying the shitty guitars from the 50s.
Right.
I love those things, too. So,
yeah.
I mean, why buy a factory-made guitar when you can buy something handmade?
Yeah, those things. Yeah.
I mean,
it's all wall full.
Yeah.
Whole guitar shop full out there.
Yeah, so you can,
Like Cobra's guitars.
I think there's more handmade electrics, like, better stuff than any factory you can buy right now.
No doubt.
Yeah.
I'm trying to tell people that. It's hard to, you almost have to educate people. Like, when I was at Chelsea Guitar, I knew they were boutique guitars. I didn't pay attention to them. If it wasn't made in the 50s, I didn't want to know about it. You know, like,
I didn't feel like there's that many. Even back in the late 90s, I didn't feel like it was like a thing.
Now it is.
Yeah.
I think the internet really helps that.
Yeah.
There were guys like, you hear James Taylor had, would he use, like, one of those Swan Builder acoustic guitars, back then,
Right.
But most guys are just had Martins.
Yeah.
Crosby, Stills, and Nashville, those guys played Martins. They always were or Gibson. That's what was good.
That's because they gave them to them.
No, but they were playing old ones.
Right.
Stephen Stills was always into, those guys weren't into old guitars.
They were also cheaper.
Yeah, they weren't expensive. Yeah. But they were into, D45s.
Have you ever seen a D45 in real life?
I don't think I have either.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of
D-42s. Yeah.
D-45s, I don't think there are many.
No, there's like a half a million.
They're like $80,000 or something for a shitty one. Right.
Boring.
But, a lot of those things. Yeah, we spend a lot of time. But you see some of these things that are, like, so sought after. Sometimes they're really amazing, and sometimes they're not.
Do you remember the White Penguin?
Which one?
Lesses?
There were two.
Yeah. Yes.
You had the second.
I tried to sell that a couple times, yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
You probably went out to jail.
No one bought it.
But that's why I remember you, because you were working with Les, after I had
working with Les. He was just
we were helping him out.
He was just a little bit of a scumbag, and he'd be like, "Take this expensive guitar and sell it," because he knew that we didn't know. We were kids, and so then we're going out trying to pawn a $150,000 guitar off as real, but we didn't know that.
Right. Well, okay. It happens to be.
Yeah.
I worked for him for a long time.
Yeah. He also had a couple of the Les Pauls that were really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have some accounts.
Yeah.
But I remember you were running around with the lights.
This man, Chris, yes, doing that, yeah. Yeah, everyone was like, I don't know. Because we took it to people who really knew them, you know. And no one wants to spend that much money. And why would a kid have a white penguin that he's trying to sell anyways?
Right. Well, there's a lot of... Because I remember... Because I had already stopped working for Les. I was working for Danny. And I remember you were helping out Les, which I appreciate because I love Les. You know, like, and you were running around with those guitars. But, like... You know, that was a strange period. It's like, you know.
Well, everyone was starting to catch on. But yeah, the White Penguin's a stupid guitar anyway. It's just a
a duo jet with a different neck. With different headstock.
Yeah.
But it's $1 million guitar or whatever. Yeah. You know, one sold, I think, recently for $500,000. But supposedly there are only 8 of them.
Right. Well, 9 of them.
But let's have 2 of them.
Yeah, 10. 10 of them. 10 of them.
What are the chances? Yeah.
The thing was, is it was a duo jet, and so you figure he would have like done the route better underneath, but he didn't.
Right.
You know, like, so people who took it apart are like, wait a minute, this is like a duo jet, and you're like, oh, why didn't he just do that better? Like, they're really going to fake it. But you know what the thing was, though, the freaking tailpiece was a penguin tailpiece, though,
for sure,
and that had to be worth what?
Right,
$20,000 for the tailpiece now.
Right,
because they didn't make them except for this. So.
Yeah, but I had a fellow who would do that conversion. You can convert them.
Right.
You know, like, I did them a couple times with people. The hard thing was the binding.
Right. It was gold, sparkly crap.
Yeah, it was really from the drums.
Right, and it was from the fell apart.
Drums, right, it fell apart. And you had to get the binding to make the conversion.
Right.
Was the thing. Because you could also convert a constellation to a falcon.
Right.
Or so if you had the binding.
Right.
Yeah, it was all.
But then you had to make the binding look like it was on there for a long time.
Right. So like, and guys still do it.
Yeah.
You know, like, but I remember back then, like, it was all about you could buy a constellation and you could make it into a falcon, which I always wanted to do.
Right.
And then someone gave me a set of a binding.
But in the end, the Gretches from the '50s were total pieces of crap.
They're funky. Yeah. But the new ones play better and all that, but they don't sound the same.
Right. I mean, they're like, they have house wiring in them. You know what I mean? They're wired with a lamp wire.
Totally.
Yeah.
But like, it's like one of those things. They have a certain sound. Like, like, you know, I have an old Gretsch. You know, like, I wanted one. You really have to have them just reconstructed.
Right.
You know,
take all
like,
the shit out and put it.
You have them refretted. You have to have the neck reset. You have to do all that stuff. But if you do it,
then after that, you have like a decent guitar.
Right. If you rebuild the entire thing,
pretty smart. Yeah.
Right. So like, you know, it's like one of those weird things. But they do have a sound you can't get out of anything else.
Yeah.
Like, you can get new Gretches. They don't sound like that.
No.
They don't sound like old Gretch. You know, but you have to love your Gretch because it's going to fuck around with you the whole time. It do new and interesting things every time you do a gig.
Right.
I remember I had one. I was so into it. I was doing a gig. And just the vibration of playing made the pole pieces start to rise and started grabbing the strings.
Fun.
So as I'm playing, it's going...
Yeah.
And I was like, ooh. Yeah. Pull this... And then...
It's an option now you can get.
That's like pulling them off the things in the middle of a gig. I'm like, like, and that's a common thing. Like, they just start unscrewing themselves and start grabbing your string.
Right. So then you have to use thread lock or something.
Right, or some crazy shit. So, anyway, we digress. So,
yeah.
Let's get back. So, how long does it take you to build a guitar?
Depending, you know, on what I'm working on. About 2 to 3 months to build a several instruments at once.
Wait,
and that's only, and that's including the finishes, yeah, because the finish takes a long time.
So how many guitars do you make a year, roughly?
So at this point, this year, starting January 1st, I hope to make 8 guitars this year.
That's not that many.
It's not that many, no. It's not. But if they were
$50,000,
that'd be great.
Right, you make them all at the same time?
No.
You make them in batches?
Yep, batches of 2 and 3. And depending on what I do, if I want to make something that's a little funky or whatever.
Right, or if they're ordered or they're...
Yeah.
You just build. So yeah. You would build 8 regardless this year whether they were ordered or not.
Whether they ordered or not, yes.
Right, because that's
so. And the ones, you know, the next guitars are all commissioned, and then the ones after that, I will have a chance to do something different. So that I can try. Yeah, so that I can try something, you know, funky or, you know, like I want to do. I have a bunch of ideas for, you know, offset sound holes, mini cutaways, you know, a whole bunch of weird stuff I want to try just to...
You ever want to build an art-top guitar, or... It's
just... You know, I would, yeah, but then I probably would be able to sell that really easy, and it seems counterintuitive, so why do that?
Yeah, easy.
Yeah.
Anyone could do easy
stuff. Yeah, anyone could do it, yeah. I thought about it, but it's a whole new skill set.
Right, it's all
different. And I could learn it, and just, I know how to do this
right.
really well, so I want to keep doing it.
This thing is incredible.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a nylon string jazz stuff I really like, because
right.
nobody, not nobody, but it's very difficult to find a high-quality handmade nylon string that has the qualities of a jazz instrument. So
right, well, there was like the Chet Atkinses.
Yeah, like,
it was the only guitar that even was like that.
Cut away a more of a different sound, also just, you know, width, fretboard width, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. You know, that if you made this, you know, more like, you know, jazz guys would play these guitars. You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is incredible. Even just playing it, just sitting here, like, doing this, this thing is amazing.
Yeah, no, they should have a little bit of a, you know, kind of a presence to
it. Yeah, it's amazing.
I mean, because, you know, with guitars, it's you're on the verge of destruction, so the top should be light enough that it sounds good, but too light, it destroys itself, too heavy, it sounds
right.
like crap. Sale.
This one? We'll talk after the thing. So your shop is in Sunset Park now?
I'm in the Brooklyn Army Terminal.
Is that like down on the water over there?
It's down there on the water at 58th to 63rd. It's a huge set of buildings.
Right, I've seen that because we came in that way.
It's pretty amazing, actually.
It's a cool area.
Yeah, it is nice.
It's funny that you wound up here, they wound up here, like, I guess this is that.
Well, you know, it's just being forced out of these for, you know. One of the things I have, the biggest problem, I'm sure these guys have this, is finding affordable space to work in New York.
Right, that's always been the problem.
Everybody wants a tech company or some bullshit, you know, to move in and pay too much money for 3 years and stuff. So, but finding, you know, when you're building things, you have to be in a space for a long time in order to, like, you got to work in it. So,
I remember your old space in Red Hook we used to go to. That was a cool space.
Oh, it was on the water. I was in an old warehouse. It was great.
It was like one of those Civil War buildings.
Yeah,
that was cool.
Yeah.
But that building turned into condos or something?
No, just, you know, again, I was renting from someone who had the lease, and so they, you know, like everything, everyone gets kicked out for some reason.
Right.
You know, I've been removed from buildings in Red Hook that were not my fault a couple times.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, well, that happens too. They sell the building. Or
I just didn't, you know, I was subleasing, but I had a lease, but I wasn't with the landlord, and then the landlord had a problem. And
right, I was going to add you go.
Yeah. Not my fault.
This thing is incredible. Guitars. Is there anything you want to tell people out there about your guitars?
I would say that other than, you know, I think other than not necessarily mine, but just people who make guitars by hand, is that, you know, each one of them has a slightly different sound, which I like.
Right.
I think finding a maker who, you know, who understands or has the same kind of sound profile that you have is really important.
Right. So this has got to be a whole different world. Like, I deal with electric guitars.
It is a whole different
world.
You
know, like, this is like a serious thing, especially if someone's going to go perform on this.
Yeah. I mean, since I've started building instruments, the character of the sound has changed. People want. Yeah. So as people started using alternative tops back in the 80s and 90s, the sound became a little bit more nasally, and what they got out of it was volume. So, you know, weird bracing patterns, double tops. You got a lot more volume, but you got a lot more mid-range and not a lot of variables. And so I think a lot of times, too, what I find is people want the trebles and mids to be a little bit more, not compressed, but have a slightly different sound because of that. So, and I think maybe it's because of compressed music these days and the way people listen
right.
to stuff. So what they hear, so I like a guitar that has, like, you know, flute trebles, really crystal clear, like traditional bracing. It's, you know, it's like very sweet.
Right.
A lot of people, if I let them play one of my newer instruments have a lot more cross bracing against the top,
right.
which closes down the top, and if you make it really light, gives it a little bit more kick. They bark a little
right.
bit more. So the trebles are a lot more barky and have a lot more, they're more mids, and they lose just a hair of that sweetness, but people like that sound. Which is weird. So it's just a matter. So you have to build to what people.
And you can tell exactly what that will do before you build a guitar. Build it and it doesn't have that sound.
Well, no, I know with bracing. With classicals, bracing is everything.
So. Is that right?
Well, bracing and a lot of other things. They have to be made really well. They have to have no tension. So the sides can't be forced. Nothing can be forced. It has to fit perfectly with just a little bit of glue,
right.
So that all the energy goes into moving the top, and that's it. So,
well, that's cool.
You know, like a lot of the old A-style mandolins and 20s Gibsons, all the butt joints come apart.
Right.
That's because they're forced together, and over time they'll come back apart. Uh-huh. So everything has to, the sides...
Is that when Lloyd Lohr came in and fixed all that shit?
I don't know that. I just know that that disease where they all pop.
Right.
Because they were forced, but... So my sides, when I put them together, squeeze.
They're just perfect.
They're perfectly inside, and that
translates into push them together.
It translates into sound. So
that makes sense.
Yeah, because especially with these, because every bit of energy matters, and so you want it all to be caught up in the sound of the top vibrating, much like a speaker, and not caught up in cross waves of finding something that they don't.
I assume it's the same thing with a steel string guitar.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, yeah. The more precise, the more...
You don't hear as much of this stuff, though. I guess it is.
You can. I mean, I think it's just depending. I mean, steel strings are a different kind of animal.
Yeah, I don't know if maybe the people are as attuned in as what you're describing.
Right.
Like, because I assume people come to your place, they could hear everything that you just described.
Yeah, or they're asked for that. And the tops are radiused on these. My new ones have a radius of the whole top, whereas I think a lot of flat tops are not quite as radiused.
Right.
Hence flat top, but it makes a big difference. You're just trying to make a speaker cone.
Right.
That's all.
Yeah, see, because when you play this thing, I've never played a classical that does this. Because you play Yamaha,
it has a resonance, and it kind of goes on for a while.
Yeah,
the energy just doesn't get caught up in other things. And it'll just,
But old Martins, they said, were like this, called portable pianos,
Right.
Where I have one, and you would do this, and it would just still be going like this.
Well, yeah, and that, a lot of times, because the tops are super thick on those, by the time now, that's why they're sounding good.
Is that right?
I bet that Martin
they didn't sound that good back
sounded
then.
Like a horse. Just
is that right?
Black. Yeah.
That's funny, because we would have just thought they sounded great back then, and they sound even better now.
No, I think they sounded terrible, because they were too thick.
Right?
Yeah, I think they were way too thick.
Like a 40s D28 or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, they probably sounded decent, but I don't, I have a feeling that, if the top's of a certain thickness, it takes a while to get that to open. So, there's that, a thin top immediately sounds good. The maturity curve is much shorter and
right.
It'll die. A thicker top, it takes a long time to get up to reach its maturity, and then it dies that way. Right. So, I bet you a 40, the one, if your 40s Martin probably didn't sound anything like what it does now.
Interesting.
I'm guessing. Right. When I string these up, brand new guitars sound like dogs. They're terrible. This, when you string up a nylon string, it just sounds like horse crap.
And how long does it take till it starts to sound?
It takes a while.
How do you make it happen?
Well,
you play it?
I keep them hanging. I started using those vibrators, string vibrators.
Right, that's a real thing.
Yeah.
Didn't old jazz guys would
put them in front of the speaker.
Put them in front of the speaker and they leave the house and play record.
And that's the problem with these. You show a brand new guitar and you're like, eh. But 2 years later, it sounds amazing.
Right. That's why we never like new guitars.
Yeah.
I still don't like new guitars. The boutique guitars tend to sound good, but they probably were doing something similar.
Yeah.
We always hate new guitars. Oh, this sounds like shit.
I hate new guitars. Yeah,
me too. But now you don't, because with the boutique guitar movement, all this, these guys ship you a guitar, and it sounds amazing the second you play
it. And that's why they build all these fancy, super thin tops out of space-age materials to simulate the aging process.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
But isn't the thinner the top, the more you could get top cracked?
Yeah, everything. It'll die faster, it'll whatever. A lot of, there were some makers in New York, Thomas Humphrey made a Millennium guitar, which is kind of beautiful design, actually. It's kind of cool. And it's a lattice brace top. And I've heard some of them years later, and they sort of diminish quickly, a little faster in sound. They don't have as much power because they're real thin and right off the bat.
Interesting. So, say Guilds from the 70s are known to have thick tops. They don't top crack very often. They sound good. But you pick them up sometimes they're heavy.
Yeah.
But they sound good.
Right.
So.
Well, I mean, sometimes you can make a guitar if it has a thick top, as long as it's balanced in a certain way, it will still sound good. But there is a limit, There's a limit to
what you can.
Yeah, you can make a thick top with light bracing, or a thin top with thick bracing, or
but those guitars are more likely to last longer.
Yes, last longer, sound better longer.
Right. See, I love old Guilds from the 70s, 60s. I always think they're the things to buy.
Yeah.
Sometimes old Martins don't sound.
Do you ever use the vibrator thing?
No.
I use it. It works on these, it takes about a week. I'm just moving him a lot, you know. And so it's a variable vice, the vibrator you set on the strings. If it's in between.
Oh, it sits on the strings?
It sits in between. You can shove it in there, and you make them for different string widths. But it's just a little box. It looks like a pickup. It works a little bit better on the archtop and the mandolins and that kind of family, because it really starts to open them up. It energizes them a lot.
Wow.
So, and what's fun is if you take one for, you should do it 2 or 3 days, A-B them like an old Martin. Right. It does make a huge difference. It will really open it up. It really just gets it moving and just gets it, you know.
So people should be doing that to their old guitar.
I think it sounds good. Just if they don't play it a lot. I mean, the thing about it is playing is the thing that makes them sound good.
Right.
So if you play the guitar a lot, it sounds good.
Well, we'd always notice that at Chelsea. Like, you know,
if it's a
they're playing
guitar,
that guitar all the time, it starts sounding really good.
Yeah, I can hear these with people playing new guitar of mine. For a half hour, the sound quality improves in a half hour. You can hear it physically improve a little bit. Yeah.
Well, I used to feel that at Chelsea. Like, you know, we would take a gold guitar and start playing it. You'd start to feel it.
Yeah.
You start to feel like,
yeah,
this sounds better than it did yesterday.
Yeah, it just needs
I even tell my own guitars. Like, I'll pull out a guitar and play it a long time, and it sounds uptight. I mean, that's the way I always describe it.
You just have to, you know, they have to come to that spot where the energy has nowhere else. You know, it's not being sucked up by something else.
Right.
It's not being, you know, redirected or...
Because if you didn't play this guitar for 5 years, if you just put it away, it wouldn't sound as good as it sounds now, right?
It would probably
stiff it up slightly.
Probably just a hair. Wouldn't take much to get it back.
Right, then you start playing it, it does it again.
Yeah.
But this, they don't die. Like, if you play this guitar for 100 years, it wouldn't...
No, they don't die. I mean, I think the more you... The whole thing about the maturity curve in guitars, I think, is the use. So,
right.
You have to, you know... That's if you're using it a lot.
But that was always the big thing, too, because we could always get those really beat-up guitars. And we'd be like, is this guitar so good-sounding that someone played it and it got beat up? Or does it sound good because it got beat up?
Yeah,
because someone played it so much.
Someone played it so much. And so then, it found the place where the energy had the least amount of resistance. And so then when you hit a string, it transfers all that energy straight to producing sound rather than getting caught up in something else.
Interesting.
That's my thoroughly, like, super scientific went to school analysis.
Right, because, you know, when you work in guitar shops, you get all these misconceptions, and it's all secondhand folklore.
Yeah.
And
like,
now with forums, it's even worse.
Really good. Yeah.
Right, you know, with forums, you know, people go like, oh, you know, PAFs were from space or whatever. You know, it's like,
oh, true story.
Space. The guy made it. You know, but you know, like, the PAF is like, you know, it's like the.
Yeah.
Thing. And every single podcast, PAFs come up, so I just made it happen again.
No.
A classical guitar podcast.
PAFs. Do I think they sound good? I mean, you could A-B them. Thing is, I've had some expensive... I had a guitar in my shop that was... I won't tell you the maker. It was old, but it was a couple $100,000. There's not that many guitars that go for classical guitars in that range.
Right.
I had a professor in, and I said, play this, but I... Don't look at it. Just play it and tell me the thing. And you know, he's a classical guitar professor, played it. He's like, nah, you know, it's okay. It's kind of bleh. And then he saw what it was, and he starts playing it again. He goes, oh, yeah. And I'm like, BS. Because that's what happens. That's
oh, no. You definitely hear with your eyes.
They're BS.
No, PAFs, I think, really are.
I mean, some of them might sound
Some of them good, sound really good,
but
right.
But there are a lot of people who make
But could you tell without looking at
no.
it? Right. Because we started doing that at the last guitar show. We started doing blind tests.
Right.
You know, like, I was wondering, if you put 450 Strats and one Mexican Strat there,
yeah.
and someone turns their back, could they pick the Mexican Strat out of those guitars?
You mean by hearing it?
Right.
Yeah. Well,
without seeing it.
Without seeing it, yeah.
Probably not.
Probably not. Especially if you reliced a little bit, no way.
Or you know, like, even if they didn't see the guitars, we could say there's 450 Strats here and one's a Mexican that was made last week.
Right.
We're going to play them all. Tell me which one's the Mexican.
Right.
Because those 450 Strats are going to sound so different to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't all sound the same because they're from the 50s. It just doesn't work that way. And they don't all sound amazing.
Yeah.
And that Mexican Strat can sound amazing.
Yeah.
So when you take your eyes out of the equation or you know what it is, when you go, hey, this guitar is from the 50s and it has PAFs, everyone's going to think it sounds amazing.
Well, that's the thing about buying guitars is you have to have someone who can say, this guitar does actually sound, you know, this guitar's worth it.
Right.
Because it sounds great.
Sounds
it might look crappy, but it sounds great.
Right. Like, Nightbop is like that. Like, you know, you'll go, like, it's good. Yeah.
How did he get the name Nightbop?
He worked at a rehearsal studio, and there was two Bobs, and one worked during the day. And one worked at night.
Cool.
So somewhere, there was a day Bob.
Was it a day Bob?
Yeah, I said, do you still know him? And he was like, no.
Yeah.
But he always figured it was like something really interesting. He's like, I worked in a rehearsal studio. I worked at night. But anyway, but he's got that those ears. You know, obviously he's a sound engineer. You know, but you know, like he has a million stories of being with like you know big rock star guys, and they're buying these guitars. And he's like, guitar sounds terrible.
Yeah.
But they bought it anyway because they thought it sounded cool.
Right.
You know, or they thought it looked cool. You know, like but
and rock and musicians like, are super smart.
but because it's a $100,000 guitar, it's got to be good.
Yeah.
You know, and they aren't all.
No.
You know, but you assume, oh, it's $100,000. It's got to be good. You know, or it's a Burst. Burst. You know, everyone talks about Bursts. And I'm sure there's things in your world that are that.
Yeah, they're investment vehicles for rich people. They're places for people to park their money and then get it out again.
Well, yeah, but sometimes they're real good.
Yeah, sometimes.
You know, like, you know yeah. and sometimes they're not so
good. So then they serve two purposes.
Right, yeah. And then there's a million fakes of them, and
yeah.
you know people buy those and think they're real and all that kind of shit. You know, like do people do that with classicals? Are there fake
the fakes? You know, there are of
like Ramirez's. Or?
It was funny because I went to the Yale Instrument Museum with a group of woodworkers. Totally, super cool event. And we were looking at furniture, but we went to there and they brought out some of their older instruments, and they had a Torres, which is the thing.
Right.
And that's the one guitar people do fake and. I was really the only instrument maker, so she let me handle it, and I'm like, wait a minute.
You know,
it's like a $150,000 instrument. And then I look inside it, and it has a little Made in Mexico sticker, or Made in Spain sticker, because I think we used to do that when we exported them. And I started looking at it, and I'm like, oh my God. And so I said, do you have two of these? Because this one is not real. I hope I didn't, you know, I was like...
Mess your world up, right?
Yeah, because this is a $150,000 guitar that you just got totally ripped off on. But that's the one guitar that they do fake.
Interesting.
But you can't fake these... really well because of the sound quality, you know, like
it just wouldn't sound that way.
Well, you'd have to mimic the sound.
About
you'd have to mimic
years of
yeah, you'd
age.
Have to mimic the exact sound of the instrument that they're known for and all that, and the wood is tough to do.
Right.
And because classicals are worth ultimately so little, why go to all that trouble to spend 6 months making something you're gonna suffer $22,000?
Right. That was the thing with the electric guitars. Like you don't see fake Martins.
No, because it's in well I mean yeah, you can, it's why. I mean it's
I mean, even make a fake D45, like, you know, like, that's guitar's worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
But you don't see fake ones, or do
no.
you? I've never heard of that.
I don't...
It'd probably be too hard.
I think anyone who has the skills to fake something that well should be making
could make
guitars
a guitar, right.
and sell it for more money.
Right, because making a Les Paul, you can make fake Les Paul, you know, I'm sure they can make one back there.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, we know how to make a Les Paul. You can
not that they're making fake
Les Not that they're Paul's doing it, but, you know, yeah. but, you know, it's so not hard compared to this.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not like someone could hear, because we know people can't hear the difference.
Yeah, they do it. The violin world is notorious for that.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, yeah, everyone in their Stradivarius.
Right.
So,
yeah,
and that is always the heartbreaking story of in the guitar store working is old people who come in and you're like, sorry, you know.
Oh, you know how many times I had to tell the person what they had wasn't the thing? You know, like, that happened a lot, like, you know, like in the 90s when I was working in guitar shops and like, people had bought the guitars in the 70s and had them under the bed. They had the Lake Placid Blue Strat. Now the kid's going to college, and the Lake Placid Blue Strat's worth $25,000, and they could use the $25,000 now. So they bring it into the shop, and you go, cool. You know, they've been talking about this guitar for years. You know, they had it. And they bring it in. They'd be like, oh, I want to sell it. I'd be like, all right, cool. You know, bring it in. And either it was a refin, or the body wasn't even Fender.
Right,
The pickups were not real, but they bought it, like, in the 70s. No one took things apart and looked.
Right, no,
You know, and it was... The $25,000 they thought they had under the bed.
Yes.
Sometimes it was worth nothing. Sometimes it was just a neck. Sometimes it was like ripe. It's a refin.
Right.
You know, but no one thought about it. And that there was a rash of that for a while because it became that time when those cats needed that money.
Sure.
You know, they were either going to retire or they had this $20,000 guitar. They don't play guitar anymore. You know. So but they were
the time
everything they brought in was bad.
Spending asinine amounts on things.
Right? Yeah, because they were buying stuff in '70s and '80s from. You know, no one took stuff apart.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, like, you would just trust that the
guy had record told collections, you. I buy records. And
that's right.
I used to buy a lot of records.
I remember.
And same thing. They were like, yeah, I have all these jazz records, or I have this or that. And never, once, ever did I go to this person's house and it wasn't good shit.
Right.
Ever. Yeah.
I remember you were doing that even back then.
Ever. It was always wrong. There was, you know, always, they didn't know what they were talking about. The only time you get good records when someone dies.
Shit. Yeah. Well, that whole thing's come back now. You know,
yes.
Because like, I listened to
came
vinyl.
Back,
like,
my way, came back, yeah.
But you were doing that way back when.
I was, yeah, I stopped doing it a little bit. It became
well, you were talking about $500 jazz records.
It became obsessive compulsive, and then, you gotta stop.
Yeah, yeah. I'm into it, but like I just like records.
Do you know how many people? Who cares that you have like an $1,800, you know, rare Coltrane record?
Right.
Nobody. What you bring over? You're like, girl, and you're like, hey, look at that. It's a record. You know, like, oh, yeah. Look, a record. Yeah. No one cares.
Well, how does that work?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know somebody whose like niece came over and didn't understand what those things were.
Oh yeah, that happens.
What the hell's that? How does that make music?
Little kids are confused by CDs. So.
Your CDs just died. I don't know. Yeah. They're stupid. I have a million of them. I'm going to play them. I just go on Spotify.
Yeah, no, I have a
But now everyone listens to records again. It's cool. So we've been at it for a while. So
taking a break?
No, we're going to
talk about something else?
Well, we have to talk about those because they're sitting right there.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those. Let's put this down.
Great.
So these are your ruby knives.
Yes.
And they are... How did you start making knives?
Well, I mean, I made knives because, you know... I do guitar repair occasionally, and I just I was just so sick of doing guitar repair in some sense. I mean, I mostly do classical repair now. So I don't
right. Well, I remember even when I was bringing you repairs, you didn't really want to do them. You would just do them.
And I just, you know, I've made some of my old hand planes, some of my own woodworking knives, you know, like violin knives, carving knives, and so and you know, I'm just it's such a guy thing. I think fascinated by pointy, sharp things.
Yeah,
and,
that you could kill people.
And the knife is just such, you know, like. Man's oldest tool, and so every time you pick it up, you're like,
makes you feel good.
With like this genetic memory, you're like, you know, stabby. Yeah. And I just started making kitchen knives because you know, they're useful. So, and I wanted, and I have a lot of friends who are professional chefs. I love to cook. I had a cooking show.
Right, you just mentioned that.
Yeah, really good, and won an Emmy for it.
You won an Emmy?
No. And I did not. It was a show about drinking and cooking, mostly drinking.
Where did we find that?
I can't remember the name of it. But I do. So the knives I make because I like. These are very difficult because they're so simple in some sense. You know, like a kitchen knife, you're just like, oh, it's just a sharp metal thing. But there's a lot more to it.
There's layers of metal.
And like guitar world, you can get absolutely insanely nerdy about everything involved with this and go, you know, down the rabbit hole of all that stuff. But, you know, I like these because people actually use them. They use them to make food with. You know, it's one of those things that you use every day, but you don't think about it kind of thing. And so that's why I like them.
No, it's very cool because I got one from you not long ago, maybe a month ago, and it changed my world.
No, it's just...
Because I cook. I love cooking. But, like, wow. Because well, I had a knife.
It's nice to have something that's sharp and something that works well. And
it really works.
You know, and I find...
But it takes a second to get used to a real knife. Not that I didn't have a real knife.
Right, no, yeah.
Like at first I was like, it doesn't cut that good.
Right, or it depends how you use it.
Yeah, learn to cut with it.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, you're sitting here cutting paper with it.
No, yeah, these will... These will shave right now.
Yeah. But, all right, this is going to be worth it. Whoa.
That is...
Are you fucking seeing that?
It is sharp.
That shit is sharp.
And that's a big knife, too. But,
Do it again.
I took one of his catalogs and I cut it up.
We didn't need this.
Yeah. So you can actually shave with this.
Wow.
Fucking sick.
That's like crazy.
But no, you know, the kitchen, like, chess is a good example of a lot of... It has only so many rules, you can only do so many things with it, but yet you will have these players who have this entire, you know, personality and style doing it.
Right.
Knives, like these, are. I mean, they're all different shapes, but there's only so many things, you know, and then you got to express yourself within a very confined sort of... Which I like, because that way it's little subtle things that make the differences. But anyway, that's why I like making knives... It's a side thing.
But you can find that you have an Instagram for your knives.
Yeah, I have an Instagram for the knives and the, and the guitars. I mean, I still mostly do guitars and knives, especially now because it's Christmas, so...
Right.
That kind of thing.
And these are all different, I assume.
Yep. I make, so basically two kind of styles are a Western style of knife, which is like your French, you know, the classic French knife.
I think that's what I have.
Which, yeah, metal goes all the way through the handle. And then Japanese styles of knife, which have, you know, thousands of different kinds of knife styles. They have a knife for every kind of fish and all sorts. So I'm very obsessive compulsive. I don't do that. But, you know, they're for slightly different styles of cooking. So Japanese, I think, are more slicers with things, and they're more a little forward, whereas the European stuff can be a lot of rocking back and forth, chopping this way, you know, that kind of thing. And it's just a matter of what people are comfortable holding.
Right.
And using.
Because like the one that Craig got looks more like a...
That is like a Japanese vegetable knife called right. Kiri, yeah.
That's really cool.
And it's, you know, it's an unusual shape if you're not used to it, but it's, you know, in a lot of Chinese kitchens, they're cooking with things that are twice that high. They're right. super thin, big cleavers, and they're cutting everything with the cleaver. But it's not a cleaver, it's just the knife. It looks thing, right. like our
cleaver. Right, his looks like a cleaver.
Yeah.
Right. That's very cool. All right, well, so we are sort of getting to the end. So, this was my wife's idea, of course. So
do I have to answer some kind of, like, trivia question?
Sort of.
Okay.
No, you have to answer 5 questions. It's the only thing that's kind of uniform on our podcast.
Okay.
Is at the end we ask 5 questions, which I forgot to bring them with me, but I think I remember most okay. of them. And they're basic questions, and most of the time you cover them during this, but sometimes you don't.
Okay.
And sometimes sure. we uncover interesting things. First off, what is something a lot of people don't know about Matt Rubidoux?
I'm optimistic.
You're supposed to tell the truth.
I am. I'm very optimistic.
Okay.
Things are going to turn out pretty good.
Okay. Okay. See, we didn't know that. Yeah. We thought you were very pessimistic.
Yeah, everyone so. Thinks that, but that's not true.
And you love people.
I love people. Yes, that's actually not true.
I know. I worked at a retail store with you. Okay, that was pretty good. What are you listening to these days?
Right now, I listen to stuff all the time. I think it's important to have giant ears. You know what right. I mean by that? Right now, I'm listening to a lot of jazz coming out of London. The jazz scene right there is amazing.
Currently?
Yep, it's amazing. There's a lot of, like, there's a big spiritual jazz throwback kind of scene, like Alice what? Coltrane stuff.
I love that stuff.
It is one of my favorites, you know, Pharoah Sanders.
And right, I love all that stuff.
But yeah, you know...
I didn't even know what people are currently doing that. Oh, like, who are some of the artists?
Let's see, the Ezra... these guys are called... this is all... I listen to this every day, but I can't remember. Ezra's song. I could come up with them a little
right.
bit. But... I'll tell you what I listen to.
But it sounds like those Alice Coltrane records?
Oh, yeah. A lot of them.
I mean, love that stuff.
There's I think it's in Liverpool or one of those smaller.
See, I would have never.
Other known than that, there's a whole, like, spiritual jazz.
Is it popular? Like, they sell a lot of records?
Yeah, I mean, jazz guys never sell a lot of records.
Right, but like, who's listening to that? Young people or just old?
Young people.
Is that right?
There's a lot of cool. I mean, it's a really. Some of it, you know, nothing is like, you know, sonship. Like the Coltrane album where he's just freaking out. Nothing right. today is that...
Right, no one would be able to deal with that, right?
I mean, well, also just the complexities. There are people who play that well, but that's rare.
Right, it's like being Hendrix again.
But yeah, there is just a lot of amazing that kind of sound.
Is it called? Is that movement called something?
Like, I don't
find
know.
That stuff.
You know? Where I listen to it on, and I'm not trying to do a shameless plug, but I listen to it all on Spotify or on Bandcamp.
I've never done
Bandcamp. Bandcamp is amazing, only for, and I am not being paid by Bandcamp, because there is a lot of stuff that is self-produced and smaller produced stuff. So most of the, like, Blue Note does not do jazz. I mean, they do new jazz, but it's light crap.
Right.
All the stuff that's coming out that is, like, anywhere, you know, any more heady or any more melodic is coming through there. You'll find, like, a lot of weird metal bands. I like a lot of electronic stuff. It's pretty amazing for new music.
That's, you know, cool
stuff. I love it.
Yeah. That's very, very cool. Okay, so those were 2 of them. Here's an interesting one. If you were not doing this, what would you be doing?
You mean, do I have to be working, or can I just be... lounging.
You could just be the drunk someplace if you wanted to be.
I don't know.
I mean, you don't have to have an answer for them.
I would,
you
know, be a machinist.
That makes sense.
I love machinists.
A lot of people were chefs. You know, a lot of people have said to the board, I'd probably be cooking.
I worked in the kitchen for,
right. No. But a lot of people, that seems to be a common thing. They're like, oh, if I wasn't building guitars, I'd probably be a chef.
I want to be a machinist. Okay, next question.
Okay, what is on the horizon for Matt Rubidoux?
The horizon?
Like, well, going forward.
I have 14 years left on my lease here in New York, which is amazing. So
that's one lease.
It is.
Is it a 20-year lease?
15. So I am, my plans are to, keep doing what I'm doing now. So guitar-wise, every guitar I make is a little bit different. part of me, because the classical scene is such a clicky scene, and if you're not the guy who's like, oh, that's the guitar everyone should have, you know, I'm sure it's the same way in a lot of things. People right. are...
What happens in the boutique guitar electric dismissive, world? Like, even if all of a sudden everybody wants that one guitar, it's just a guitar. It's always just been a guitar.
And so at this point, you know, I'm not that guy in that scene, which is great.
Right.
And I kind of want to just start making weirder and more experimental instruments. Things that I like, things that I think look good, sound good, you know. Same this and the knives, too. I just want to keep, you know, pushing the envelope of what I do. So, you know, trying to make the best thing I can make. Because in the end, I could care less, this is not good to say, about the people who play them. That's not true. But in essence, I'm just competing with myself.
Right. That's what you're supposed to be doing.
I just want to make something great.
And you're supposed to make a better guitar each time.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a game that I'm playing with myself to see, and that's really what is important at this point.
That's why you're
supposed to. And also to be able to keep doing it. That's all I want to do.
That's it. I think that is it.
I have four questions.
I know. Well, the other one you kind of answered. You know, like, what were you doing before this?
I was cleaning my shop.
No, not directly. What were you doing before the whole guitar thing? What were you doing right before you came here?
I was cleaning the shop.
Just out of curiosity.
Absolutely filthy.
What are you doing right after this?
Eating a bagel, drinking coffee, cleaning the shop. Yeah.
No, like what, did you have weird jobs before you got into the guitar thing?
Oh, I did work in some restaurants, you know.
A lot of people did that, right?
Because it was very easily accessible. I like the mental part of it, you know. Right. Being in the weeds when you're so backed up is really thrilling. It's an absolute panic without having to jump off something.
Right.
Like being panicked. I had no really weird jobs.
Yeah, like Josh from Protocaster made curtains. You can find some interesting. That question sometimes yields some really interesting things.
I cooked a night shift at a 24-hour diner in Lafayette, Indiana, on a college campus.
That was fun.
Football players, I watched people pass out in biscuits and gravy. I started food fights, in which the whole restaurant started throwing food at each other. I got everyone to do the wave. It was awesome.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, they were just drunk.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, Indiana seems to be like the highest alcoholism rate.
I would say it's Wisconsin. Wisconsin has... No, they do. Wisconsin has the best bars in the Midwest.
Is that right?
They have... You can find these great local bars that are not full of dirtbags, but like all your friends go... really warm, inviting, lots of food, people hang out. I think the Wisconsin drinking culture is great.
All right, well, we got to go to Wisconsin. It seems.
Road trip.
Yep, right after this. Yeah. Go to Wisconsin. Awesome. Well, Matt, it has been an absolute pleasure.
It was really fun, actually.
Do you have a website?
Yes.
You must.
I think it's mattrubendahl.com and rubyknives.com.
Oh, they actually... I didn't know they had their own website.
They have their own website.
And you're on Instagram, obviously. Yep. You don't do much Facebook. You're mostly Instagram.
I mean, I Facebook when I post on Instagram, but yeah, right. Facebook confuses me.
But it has been an absolute pleasure.
It's been fun.
Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you.